This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And now, part two of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
With author William Darity, Professor of Public Policy, African and African American Studies and Economics, and the Director of the Du Bois Center on Social Equity at Duke University. I think your book does a masterful job on really talking about how racism and discrimination choked economic opportunity for African Americans at nearly every turn. One of the things that I want you to elaborate on, just turning to the political activism for a minute, how was it that neither periods, and for me, one of the most constructive and meaningful periods that we still haven't replicated in the history of this country was Reconstruction. And again, people, please read Du Bois' Black Reconstruction, but this certainly,
phenomenal.
If you haven't, and read it again if you have, but, yeah. You know, the Reconstruction period, the New Deal, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, for that matter. So we have Black Lives Matter today. We had the Black Liberation Movement, same initials. How is it that during all of these really prescient periods and dramatic time of coming together of various sectors and movements within the African-American community, that somehow we weren't able to make advances economically and deal with the wealth gap? What happened? Was it that the movements themselves didn't focus on that? Isn't that indeed something today that Black Lives Matter perhaps is, which is in its very embryonic form certainly, and has accomplished worldwide recognition of such important issues, but has not necessarily raised up the economic, the wealth gap as essential components that continue the discrimination, the disparity of treatment and opportunity for people who are African American and people who are Black in, frankly, the world community?
It's my impression that the movement for Black lives, insofar as they focus on what they call reparations, are primarily concerned with pulling the knife out rather than healing the wound. And as I've said, pulling the knife out is essential, but it is not sufficient. If we really are going to address the huge disparities that exist in this society, we can't do so without honing in on the racial wealth gap. But, you know, why have these various movements tended not to be ultimately successful? You know, we know in the case of the Reconstruction era that the primary reason why radical Reconstruction was not fulfilled is because of essentially white mob violence and terror campaigns that were conducted largely by the former Confederates. Unfortunately, in the aftermath of the Civil War, the price of reconciliation between the white North and the white South was the absolute dismissal of any claims for full citizenship that the formerly enslaved possessed. That essentially the restoration of solidarity between the white North and South was achieved at the price of destroying black rights. And so it's actually white violence that lies at the heart of the elimination of the Reconstruction-era project. And had that project been fulfilled, had blacks received land grants, had blacks been able to continue to participate fully in the electoral process in the United States, then it's quite possible that we wouldn't be talking about reparations in 2020, that we would not have had this 155-year period where the promise that was offered in the Reconstruction era lay continuously unfulfilled. And I think that white violence lies at the heart of various points at which equity-enhancing measures have actually been deflected, destroyed, or watered down in some way. So I think we have to look at the use of force, particularly by individuals who were ex-Confederates or who in this present moment are sympathizers with the Confederate cause to some degree as the agents of resistance to restitution.
I'm Amy Rosenberg with the great pleasure of speaking about From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century with Professor William Darity. And I want to then begin to move into how you have constructed a model or how you begin to put in place a mechanism given your critique of H.R. 40, which, as you said, is mostly a proposal and what is missing from that proposal in general and sets up effectively a study commission and little else. But and we've looked at another manifestation of through Asheville of what has been done with some effort to look at the racial wealth gap and talk about Reconstruction. So we have promoted you, or maybe it wouldn't be a promotion, let's say Secretary of Labor or some facsimile in the U.S. In a shiny new administration. What would you begin to do as really setting up a process and a model for, is it about the redistribution of wealth? How do we bridge that wealth gap and get that wealth back as compensatory, and it should be compensatory, and speaking as a lawyer, compensatory and punitive and actual damages for what people of African ancestry have endured in this society through systemic white supremacy, which of course continues through today.
I don't believe that a reparations project can be executed by the executive branch in the absence of congressional action. So I think that the prior step to any kind of administrative action of the type that you're describing must be the enactment of a legislation, must be the enactment of a reparations plan by the United States Congress as the ultimate representative of national government. And so I think that the real issue is what are the terms and characteristics of the profile of that legislative act that would bring reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery into existence. And I think it's essential, as I've said, that the legislation first designate Black American descendants of U.S. slavery as the appropriate recipients of compensation, that the legislation indicate that it is going to be executed in such a way that it erases racial wealth differences in the United States. And third, that it focuses on the direct payment of funds to the eligible recipients as the way in which racial wealth differences get eradicated.
I want to pick up on that in a moment, but I just thought of one of the things that was a thread that was still hanging in my own mind when we moments ago spoke about the Reconstruction era, the Civil Rights era, and the New Deal. Why wasn't, for example, and we can just pick on one of them, like the New Deal, what went wrong there? What wasn't right about trying to build in? Was it still just a matter of white supremacy that precluded the New Deal from really sculpting and constructing the kind of wealth generating and wealth return or distribution from whatever the military or other sources to really fund community service needs and allow for the continuing generation of wealth that had been deprived from the black community. What politically didn't happen there that was it simply a matter of racism that was an opportunity that created still a disparity with all of the good things that were generated in the New Deal, for example?
The New Deal was the product of a compromise between the Roosevelt administration and the cadre of Southern Democratic Party politicians who Roosevelt needed to actually bring the New Deal legislation into action. The Southern Democratic politicians insisted that the New Deal legislation be designed in such a way that it excluded large numbers of black Americans from the benefits. And they did this by essentially depriving individuals who were employed as farm workers or as domestic servants from having access to the eligibility requirements for the New Deal benefits. So that's one instance in which it was the way in which the political process operated, and it was the way in which, once again, you know, sort of the descendants of the Confederacy actually blocked black access to resources that were being provided to white Americans. The same thing happened in the aftermath of World War II with the GI Bill, which was the most important legislation that was introduced in the 20th century to promote social mobility. It was allocated in such a way that local authorities were given substantial discretion over who could receive benefits from the GI Bill and how much they could receive. And this resulted in high levels of exclusion of black veterans from the benefits. Perhaps in one of the most extreme cases, Ira Katz Nelson observes in his book, When Affirmative Action Was White, that in the state of Mississippi, there were only two returning black veterans who received the benefits that would have permitted them to have support and assistance in purchasing homes, whereas virtually all of the returning white veterans got that benefit.
I still haven't picked up the final thread of a descriptive way of proceeding, but I, having been very involved in the movement for affirmative action and pressing hard against Alan Bakke, who engaged in a theory which was brought ultimately to the Supreme Court of reverse discrimination, and seeing the courts carve away at affirmative action, which was quite simply to help level the playing field for the historic detriment of disparate treatment that occurred, that consistently set up roadblocks to people realizing their full potential. But we have that kind of terrifying backlash, and we have the awful people like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who will, of course, say, I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us were currently living, is responsible. It's not a good idea, etc. So there's a political backlash even to a process like affirmative action, which took nothing away from anybody but simply tried to, as I said, perhaps level the playing field as much as that is possible, and with all kinds of qualifications, so as not to, regardless of various court decisions, discriminate against, quote unquote, against others. So how do you begin to deal with the politics of the Mitch McConnell statements that it's not our burden? It happened 150 years ago. What does that fall upon this generation? And doesn't that inherently create an inequity? So what is it he doesn't understand about the conceptual framework of reparations, which certainly has happened for people around the world in many instances, and certainly for why there should be a case for reparations for people of African ancestry?
Let me say first that affirmative action is an anti-discrimination measure, so it is another step towards pulling the knife out, but it is not a measure that compensates individuals who were excluded as a consequence of discriminatory practices. It's not a measure that provides them with compensation or restitution for their exclusion. Affirmative action is not reparations. It is not sufficient for addressing the kinds of disparities that we have in mind. In particular, since affirmative action provides people with access to educational institutions and to jobs that they wouldn't otherwise have, but that primarily affects their income and has much less of an effect on their wealth position. So affirmative action is not the whole story by any means. It's only a small part of the story. But with respect to Mitch McConnell's position that there's no one living today who is enslaved and there's no one living today who is a slave owner, and therefore the question of reparations is irrelevant, is particularly disingenuous coming from him, since he is the descendant of a family that owned individuals who were slaved, and that family benefited from the enslavement of other human beings. But in addition, his analysis is predicated on the view that the case for reparations is only attributable to the harms of slavery. But once we move into the next phase, where we're talking about legal segregation in the United States during the Jim Crow period, Mitch McConnell was very much alive during that period, as I was as well. I'm a living victim of legal segregation in the United States. Now, if the country waits long enough, and I'm pretty elderly now, if the country waits long enough, there won't be any more living victims of Jim Crow, just like there are no more living victims of slavery. But this type of national act of procrastination is not a justification for failing to meet the bill year after year after year. And then the final point I want to make is folks who are living today are either beneficiaries or they are the individuals who were harmed by the long-term consequences of the enslavement that took place in the United States. And so it's not irrelevant to our current lives. In fact, it's the crucible that has shaped our current lives.
Professor, the prescriptive way that we proceed, of course, you talked about the Congress, et cetera. Politically, at this present moment, it's an educational moment for sure. The basic fact is that whites have more wealth than blacks. However, you measure it by how partly that's a consequence of history and partly that's a consequence of ongoing dynamics, certainly of white supremacy historically, et cetera. So where do we go from here? How do we strengthen the narrative, the demand, the consideration for and realization of the wealth gap, the wealth inequity, and the imperative for reparations within the context of this society? What does that look like? Take us through that process.
I think it's important that we continue to try to ensure that all of us have the most accurate story of the nation's past, particularly the nation's past that's encapsulated in the critical turning points that are associated with slavery, the end of slavery, the Civil War, and the Reconstruction era. Those are points in American history where I think we've largely been captured by false narratives that have been promoted by lost cause advocates, Confederate sympathizers like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, who've exercised a tremendous amount of influence on what is actually taught in our nation's school. So that's the first aspect that we need to push forward on a sustained basis towards a more accurate story about how American history has unfolded. But the other thing is that I think that this is a moment that holds a great deal of promise. If you go back to the year 2000, there was a survey that was done by Michael Dawson and Ravana Popoff, two scholars at the University of Chicago, where they found that 4% of white Americans endorsed reparations for black Americans. And that's four, F-O-U-R. About a year and a half ago, that proportion still was relatively low, but had risen to about 15%, which is a substantial difference from the original 4%. And today, I think in the aftermath of the various protests that we've seen, the recognition, the widespread recognition of the persistence of anti-black police violence, the most recent poll that I've seen suggests that 39% of white Americans endorse reparations in the present moment, black reparations. I'm not sure if that number is accurate, but if it is, that represents a sea change. And it also raises the question of whether or not that is sustainable, because it needs to be sustained for congressional action to take place ultimately. But all of those numbers, to the extent that they are accurate or credible, all of those numbers suggest that we are moving in the right direction. Not sure where we'll end up. But it certainly is a different set of circumstances for many that I've experienced in my lifetime.
I just can't help but ask another question, if I may. And I've followed Sir Hilary Beckles for years and years and years, who is consistently, he's a Barbadian historian, current vice chancellor of the University of the West Indies, and chairman of the CARICOM Reparations Committee. And to my way of thinking, to the world community, he has brought such historic knowledge, such eloquence and activism towards certainly emanating from the West Indies to the issue of reparations. And I wonder if you look also as a political model to our comrades, to our brothers and sisters, such as Hilary Beckles, to help formulate and move forward the imperative, the righteous demand that is reparative in nature, for sure, of reparations.
So Hilary Beckles and I have known each other for upwards of 40 years.
Yeah, I figured.
We first met at a conference that was held in, of all places, Bellagio, Italy, that was on Eric Williams's book, Capitalism and Slavery, which has been highly influential to my way of thinking. And I would argue that black people throughout the African diaspora probably all have a claim for reparations. The question is, who is the culpable party that they should locate the claim against? And so in the U.S. context, it's a claim that must be made by black American descendants of slavery that took place in the United States. But on the other hand, if we're talking about the CARICOM countries, particularly the CARICOM countries that were former colonies of Great Britain, then the appropriate culpable party for their claim is the United Kingdom. For Haiti, for example, the appropriate culpable party for their claim is France. And, of course, mm-hmm. the irony there is Haiti actually paid reparations to France. They need to get that money back with interest. So that's the story that I extract from cross-group solidarity, is that we each have claims to make, but we have to carefully craft them for the appropriate culpable party.
And did I inadvertently eclipse or leave out, I'm sure that I did, a particular synopsis, a coda for what you would like to communicate to our listeners, again, at a very, very strategic moment in history that was generated by the really hashtag multiple Black Lives movement, Black Lives Matter movement. Yes, it's a movement. It's decentralized. It's now worldwide. But a final thought, Professor?
I just would like to say that I do think that there's something quite unique about the present moment. It seems like a propitious moment. I'm not sure it will ultimately result in reparations that are 155 years overdue, but I'm always optimistic.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your decades and decades of work, and strongly encourage the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. The issue of white supremacy is certainly an attitudinal issue, but it is an institutional issue. And as we would suggest in the law, it has to be torn out root and branch, and there has to be, as far as I'm concerned, punitive damages. There needs to be actual damage. There needs to be compensatory damages for people who have suffered the theft of their bodies, their labor, the wealth from their communities collectively, and the actual indignities of a system of white supremacy. Professor Darity, I thank you for taking the time to be with us and for the incredibly important research that you do, and providing us with a sense of how to move forward, both an activist period, and it also should be a period where we study and think and draw from people such as yourself to be able to frame the demands to respond to the historic inequities that have and continue to exist. Again, thank Professor you. William Darity, you're wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been good.
I've been speaking with Professor William Darity, Professor of Public Policy, African and African American Studies and Economics, Director of the Du Bois Center on Social Equity at Duke University, and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies. Professor Darity joined us to speak about his newest work, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.